Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's geographically challenged Kieran Maguire. How are you, Kieran, this morning?
I'm very good, thanks, Kevin. Yeah, all tickety-boo.
Good. You're going to get a lot of atlases sent to you at Christmas, judging by the social media response to you accidentally booking a holiday in Cape Verde rather than Tenerife. It's Questions Day, Kieran, but guess what? There is a big news story to discuss. There's an old Chinese curse, Kieran, that says, may you live in interesting times. And that's certainly the case for Derby fans. But big developments in the past 2 days for Derby fans.
Yes. Pride Park has been acquired by a local businessman called David Clowes. He has also said that he is lending the club some money, which is important because we're recording this on the 26th of June and the wages need paying pretty quick. And I think it's also fair to say the person who paid the May wage bill isn't necessarily in the best of humour at present. And certainly I don't think that person was going to pay the June wage bill. So this is positive news. In the sense that he is a genuine Derby fan, and I'm not sure the same could be said, despite protestations to the contrary, in respect of Mel Morris. And whoever ends up buying Derby Football Club from the administrators or the assets, which could be Mr. Clowes himself, I think we'll have somebody who is not at the 11th or the 59th second, I've decided to increase the rent, as was a bit of the fear in respect of some of the bidders. So this is a positive, I think I was a bit concerned. I think in the last pod, for the first time, that we weren't going to guarantee to get this one over the line, but this makes me feel a lot happier.
Yeah, I'd be disappointed if the local press don't have a Santa Claus headline. it's not just an assumption, Kieran, is it? Because the Quantumar have said that he's now their new preferred bidder, and it seems logical to assume that if he's bought the ground, he's going to try and buy the club. But while this is good news, we know from experience, Kieran, and that's very rarely followed by more good news for Derby fans. But yeah, the EFL, how many more preferred bidders are the administrators going to be allowed to have before somebody says, come now, this is really time to pull the plug on this?
Well, we did see with Wigan Athletic when the club went into administration that they had a preferred bidder who pulled out. And again, I can only go back to my own experiences in the industry, admittedly this was a few years ago. It's the nature of the beast. You get some glorified tire kickers, time wasters, and unfortunately, in the case of Derby County, they had a couple of spectacular ones pre-administration, and in the case of Chris Kirchner, they've had a spectacular one. And I could put a number of words after the word spectacular when it comes to my opinion of Chris Kirchner this time round. But I think the positives here is that David Clowes he's a local lad. He is a Derby fan. I think the one slight question mark would be, well, why has he waited until June when the club was put into administration last September? And certainly we have been aware that he has been in talks with Mel Morris with regards to the stadium. But that's now sorted. Mel Morris is effectively out of the equation from the stadium perspective, which, again, is a positive. So the EFL are not in a position to say yay or nay to any number of preferred bidders. All they can do is that if an offer is made, then they have to assess the person in respect of the owners and directors test. I've taken a look at the accounts of Clowes Developments and they look good to me. You know, the company generates money. It is profitable. So that's a positive. It's not as if it's a loss-making business that is being linked to the club.
From the EFL's perspective, though, Kieran, without a buyer, the money is running out. The fixtures, you know, Derby will have to show they can fulfil their fixtures, and they're shortly going to be down to a squad of about five or six, aren't they?
They are, well, yes, I think they're practically there already because players have got wage. Yeah, they've got bills to pay, just of as course. We all have. And I think some tentative offers were made, but the club could not commit to them because the club is being run by the administrators and they don't know whether there will be sufficient resources. Wayne Rooney has asked to be relieved of duties and I think almost universally appreciated for his fantastic efforts. Yeah, he was sleeping overnight in his office to be able to answer the phone first thing in the morning. He's trying to recruit players. He has been in my opinion, absolutely magnificent throughout all of this, and has kept in touch with people who have lost their jobs, has rallied people around. But it must be pretty draining for anybody to have to go through that on a day to day basis for so long. He walked into a mess. I think when he first joined the club, because Mel Morris was up to his Mel Morris type activities already then. And when he moved into the management role, I don't think he was necessarily given the full picture.
Yeah, Rooney has been absolutely fantastic, Kieran, but let's be honest here. Even before he went to Derby, he slept in the office a couple of times for various reasons. You've answered one quick, because I've written down here, where's Clough been all our lives? So you've sort of raised that question yourself. The Rooney thing, again, is unfortunate for Derby. It seems that Derby can't get good news without some bad news almost immediately following. And, of course, people will put two and two together and say, well, Rooney, the timing of Rooney leaving seems very suspicious, coming almost immediately off the back of the announcement of this bloke coming in. So do we think they are linked, or do we just think that Rooney's had another offer? Yeah, again, rumours about him going to Everton, with Lampard coming back to Derby in return, which just seems ridiculous. But in the absence of any information, football fans will speculate, won't they?
Yes. Yeah, football gossip loves a vacuum. It did seem a little bit strange that the two events effectively took place on the same day. I mean, I was phoned up by Radio Derby at 6:30 on Friday morning to go through what had been happening. And that was before the Rooney announcement. I think Wayne Rooney perhaps feels somewhat chastened that he started to build up a relationship with Chris Kirchner. A bit of a Walter Mitty, but quite persuasive, quite charming. And you can understand that Wayne Rooney feels pretty disappointed with regards to some of the promises were made by an individual who made a big fuss about conducting the deal via social media, and now has gone completely off loop.
Yeah. Two more things before we end this story. Two things to clarify. A lot of people are speculating on social media that because David Clough is lending the club the money, presumably to pay the wage bill, it was therefore him who must have paid last month's wage bill. But we don't think that's the case, do we?
Not according to our sources, which I'm pretty confident in. So I think that was another third party, a pretty decent individual stroke consortium. I'm not going to give any details away, but it was paid in good faith on the understanding that the Kirchner deal was going to go through.
And finally, Kieran, on that Kirchner deal, and I don't know whether this reflects badly on the administrators or not. You might be able to enlighten me on that, but it's becoming quite clear that Kirchner is in serious financial trouble. Anyway, his own business is in big problems. So would the administrators not have known that before? Would they not have done some sort of due diligence? Because it seems to me that he never had the money to buy it in the first place.
Well, it does seem strange in relation to Kirchner, but it is possible in the modern world to give the impression of X when in fact Y might be the case. I was reading Logistics News on Friday.
You're reading what?
logistics news.
Well, I bet that gets delivered on time, doesn't it? Why the bloody hell were you reading logistics news? Where do you get the time to put your feet up and get just leaf through a copy of logistics news over a cup of tea and a digestive?
Well, I'm naturally curious bloke.
We're all naturally curious, Kieran, but we turn to websites, not logistics news.
So I was taking a look at logistics news, and it appears that Mr. Kirchner's own company, Sync.io, was unable to pay the wages of staff last month. And we have reported on that. Yeah, we've mentioned this before. And there's also, again, this is based on social media, so we have to be slightly cautious in relation to this, that his private jet is effectively up for sale on eBay or somewhere similar, which would indicate that perhaps he is in need of cash urgently to pay things. So further evidence that, we're hoping we'll be able to say in a couple of weeks, all's well that ended well. In respect of Derby County, because Chris Kirchner would have been a disaster.
Right. Good. Well, let's hope and pray that it will be maybe only a matter of days before we can say that Derby County are safe in the ownership of David Clowes, who you seem to think is a safe pair of hands. So let's move on to questions, Kieran. And we've got some interesting and rather lengthy ones. There's a couple you might have to. Of course, I prepare, Kieran, but there's a couple that I stopped reading halfway through. So, just so the second part of the question would come as a surprise to me as well as to you, basically.
Well, yeah, they're supposed to be questions, not books.
Yes. Yeah, well, no, and that's not a criticism because they're all good questions. Yeah, but, you know, Kieran, remember people, try and keep the questions short because Kieran needs his time to read logistics news. That'll be a good postcard. Maybe the fact that Chris Kirchner's plane is up for sale, that might explain why Guy's gone radio silent in the last couple of days. getting a new plane. Mike Dunn has the first question. And Mike Dunn has a question about his club, Newcastle. And again, it's one of those questions where so many of our listeners are asking about fancy ways of getting around FFP. And Mike says, if Newcastle want to sign a genuine world star but wanted to keep the mega wages off their FFP calculations, how creative can they get with paying companies owned by the player? For example, if they decided to spend $50 million on a stadium and training ground improvements, so not included in FFP spends, of course, could they funnel it through a company owned by the said world star to bolster his wage packet? Anything to stop this happening? Are there similar schemes already happening? An interesting question in terms of Newcastle, because already news coming out of Newcastle that the Eddie Howe's been told that they haven't got mega millions to spend because they want to stay within FFP regulations.
Yeah, I think that's trying to dampen down, A, the expectations of the fan base, and B, to try to send a message to other clubs who might be trying to charge a Newcastle premium in respect of transfer dealings.
Right, okay.
Based on my calculations, and I know Swiss Rambles put out something similar in respect of this. And you know, if the governor says he believes these numbers, and I always believe the governor as well,
yeah, cool.
Newcastle could quite easily spend £500 million on players.
Half a billion,
because of our good friend amortization comes to the rescue.
Of course,
and you cut the costs by 4 or 5. So. There are broadly two ways to circumvent financial fair play. The first of which is to artificially boost revenues. And Newcastle are in a more challenging position because as soon as the takeover took place, purely by coincidence, the Premier League introduced a new rule that every single sponsorship or commercial deal worth over £1 million has to go to their fair value committee to ensure that there's no artificial boosting of the numbers there. So that's one way. The other way, which is effectively what Mike is referring to, is a way of deflating or transferring costs elsewhere. Now, what we've seen elsewhere. And unfortunately, we go back A to Derby County and B to our favourite story of the podcast, where a player's mother was recruited as an academy scout on $700K a year. Because that's because academy costs aren't cost. And what Mike is referring to is infrastructure costs. What he's saying is conceptually true. I think there is a greater degree of scrutiny now from the authorities. But we have seen, if we take the case of, can we transfer those costs elsewhere? So let's take the case of Neymar. Neymar, as we know, plays for PSG, which is owned by the Qatari authorities. And Neymar also, a few years ago, became a global ambassador, Kevin, global ambassador for the Qatar National Bank.
Oh, for the bank. That's nice.
Which, of course, isn't owned by the football club owners, so therefore is completely independent. And, footballers are, as we know, are entitled to strike deals for their image rights, for association, for marketing purposes, and that happens all the time. But certainly this form of parallel contract, which goes with a party which is sort of, but no, doesn't fall within the definition of a genuine related party from the accounting point of view, that could be the case. And therefore, what you can do, let's say that Neymar wanted £40 million a year, PSG said, well, we can't afford to do that for FFP purposes. So therefore, they pay him $10 million a year and he gets $30 million a year from the Qatar National Bank. That would appear to be within the rules. I'm sure he's doing an absolutely magnificent job for the Qatar National Bank. When you go to pay in a check at your local branch, wouldn't it be fantastic if Neymar was at the other side of the till? That'd make my day.
Wouldn't it, Joe? I've been wondering why the Bank of Qatar has been all over the high street in Norbury recently. And it's not, obviously, imagine being the ambassador for the Bank of Qatar. Imagine the Ferrero Rocher that ambassador would get. Oh, my God. There's a reference for some of the younger listeners.
Yes.
Alan Hemphill has our next question. Thank you, Alan. It's an interesting one. Alan says, you mentioned on a recent show about a foreign gambling company. Do you like gambling? I don't know. I haven't gambled for a long time.
reference.
Associated with Manchester United, a gambling company associated with Manchester United. If, as been discussed, gambling companies get banned from sponsoring football clubs in the UK, would clubs still be able to be sponsored outside the UK by foreign gambling companies and receive benefits in that way?
The simple answer is highly likely that they would be able to do that. Right. If there is going to be any form of government white paper with regards to this, it looks as if it's going to be restricted to front of shirt deals. So therefore, you could have a official casino partner in the Philippines, in Macau, wherever it's going to be. And that would be okay. I think the only restrictions could be, again, going back to our favorite polythene board behind the players with the names of sponsors. Yeah. Perhaps it wouldn't make political sense to have that. But perimeter advertising in respect of the gambling industry, that there appears to be not a lot of desire to stop that from generating revenue. So therefore, having overseas partners getting involved in deals with them where a couple of players turn up and they smile and gurn for the product, which is a gambling product, I would imagine is likely to continue. And also in respect of what's going to happen in terms of gambling, the vibes I'm getting is that everything is being diluted and watered down as much as possible here. And I think the government would, in an ideal world, doesn't particularly want to get involved and would rather, it's perhaps sort of saying to the Premier, why don't you just have a voluntary ban and we don't have to get involved and then everything else can go, everything else can go on as before.
Yeah, it's interesting that as Palace now have Sinch as their sponsor after 7 or 8 years of various dodgy-looking Far Eastern gambling companies. And one of the things Palace are talking about is they wanted kids to be able to buy the same shirts as their dad.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting one. I mean, and everyone's really pleased that we've got a non-gambling company. Just the timing of it, because Palace are selling it as though, you know, this is deliberate. We wanted to get rid of a gambling company before the government did. But I imagine these negotiations have been going on for quite some time, way before the news of the gambling thing came in anyway, I would guess. And I'm not being cynical here, Kieran, because that's and that's not your job, because you're not cynical, are you?
No. And we've also seen, I think, is it 20,000 Everton fans have signed a petition saying
yes.
They don't want I said, let's be honest, we both gamble, you and I.
And
we are not anti-gambling at all. We live in such a binary world that if you've got reservations about something, that means you've got to be either wholly yay or wholly nay. And that's not the case. I think with the Cinch deal in respect of Everton, I think it was the only two seasons since 2003 that kids have been able to wear the same shirts. Yeah, because we all remember Chang Beer.
Yeah,
and I always thought that was a good part. I just like the logo. I don't drink, but I have no objection to things. You know, but it's a very sensitive subject, I don't think we're really going to get a very good deal for people who are impacted by gambling, and ideally don't need it to be bombarded with suggestions and encouragements to involve in the industry. And you and I, again, we're both old enough to remember the John Player Sunday League, Benson and Hedges Cup in cricket.
Gillette Cup, all that,
And cricket still exists.
Yeah. I don't know why I said Gillette Cup, Kieran, because clearly it's a razor blade. I was just in a pub then at 10:30, just throwing random words in. Gillette Cup, Carling Cup, Joe Dunn asks a question that I probably should have asked before, to be honest. So it's a sort of question I like. And Joe says, you were discussing Rochdale recently, and I was just wondering, when they or other clubs, for that matter, issue additional shares, how do people go about buying them? And can this only be done by people in the UK, or can people abroad buy them too? Now, because we talked about Lincoln the other day, and we've talked about clubs issuing shares before, but I've never asked you that question. How do you buy it? Are they advertised? Or are you expected to find out by word of mouth? Is there a column in the back of Logistics News whereby they say Rochdale shares are up for grabs? Or
Finley doesn't like that question, does he? You see him leaving.
It's always the third question. it's associated in his mind with he's counting. It's Wonky Chomp's time. He's out. Right.
In respect to this, it does vary from club to club, because what you have to consider is what's known as the club's Articles of Association, which is effectively the club's internal constitution. Now, in respect of some clubs, there will be things which are referred to as preemption rights, and preemption rights means that if a company, which in this case will be a football club, is considering issuing shares, then it must first of all issue those shares to existing shareholders so that their percentage stake in the company is not diluted. So if I own 75% of the shares in the company, in a club, and the club says, well, we're thinking of issuing new shares, the first thing they've got to do to me is to say, well, you know, if we want to do this share issue, we're going to give you, or we will offer you X shares, which will keep you as a 75% owner, and then we're prepared to issue them to the public and so on.
The person with 75% shares who's offered those X shares, he has to pay for those shares.
That person would have to pay for them, but at least they would be given the choice. That's a way of maintaining your relative stake in the club. In the company, if that's what you want to do,
is that not also a way of forcing somebody out then, if you think they're not going to have the funds to buy these extra shares?
Yes, it is. We have seen in respect of some clubs where there has been a new majority owner, What they then do is to say, well, I'm prepared to put more money into the club. You've got to match me. And the especially if the other shareholders tend to be local or you know, don't have the resources, what they find is that their stake is continually diluted from ongoing share issues. But at the same time, you know, from a positive point of view, the club is getting more money. So you know, there's different stakeholders that we have to consider here.
Right. Okay. So back to the articles of association. You've offered the 75% share. So what happens next?
Right. Well, what's also can be the case is that if under the club constitution, and there are clubs such as Rochdale, which you know going back to Joe's original question, which Rochdale, yeah, we always say we like Rochdale,
yep,
connections with the cooperative movement and so on, and they're very proud that they don't have a majority owner, and, yep, and therefore it has to be effectively a broad consensus that carries the club forwards. There is nothing to stop a football club from issuing £1 shares for £1 to as many people as want to buy the shares. And the way that they would do that today, they probably announce it on the club website. It's a bit of a faff under certain circumstances, but there's plenty of clubs that have, when you actually go through what's known as the confirmation statement, which a club has to put out each year, clubs will list out, you know, many, many hundreds of shareholders who have historically invested in the club, normally for an emotional reason, you know, because they love the club and they, yeah, had an opportunity to put a bit of money in. You know, these people don't expect a financial return. At the same time, things can get a bit sensitive. If we take a look at, you know, there's ongoing issues with West Brom. I'll say no more than that. With regards to minority shareholders who, yeah, feel that perhaps they've been squeezed out of having their voices heard.
Right. And the last part of Joe's question: can anybody buy shares? It's not just based in the UK, presumably.
No. This would be available to all. Again, this, you know, under the terms of the club's constitution. Yeah, you. I don't think it would. I've never seen any issues which have been restricted to domestic shareholders.
Right.
And if we think about what's happened in football, you know, both the Premier League and the EFL is awash with owners from all over the world.
Yeah, and I suppose the computer doesn't know where you're buying your shares from either, does it? You could be anywhere.
True. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, speaking of all over the world, our next question comes from Kerry Kavanagh. Kerry says, I am an American listener, so hello to you, Kerry. Recently, there have been some college American football coaches move for enormous contracts, which made me curious how much managers in Premier League and the Championship get paid. How does that compare to other European countries? What type of incentives and benefits would be included, and does it all go towards FFP?
Right. Yeah, you know, an individual's contract of employment is a private matter. So yeah, that isn't accessible as far as the public domain is concerned. At the same time, you know, there's lots of websites which seem to be. I'm ITK on this, mate. So as far as the Premier League is concerned, probably at the bottom, you know, we're probably talking around about £2 million a year. At the top level, you know, here, you know, we know who we're talking about: Guardiola, Klopp, perhaps Conte. You know, in the region of £15 to £20 million, and then they are very heavily incentivized. And I know I've mentioned this before because he's not one of my favourite people on the planet, and it's the only time I think I've ever cheered Crystal Palace. But Mr. Pulis, who was given a £2 million bonus for avoiding there were two elements to this in terms of incentivization. First of all, the club had to avoid relegation. That was the sad bit, which came true. And secondly, he had to still be employed at the end of August,
yeah,
I think it was.
Yeah.
And he went to the club and said, "Oh, you know, I really need this £2 million." Yeah, we all do that, don't we? We, you know, pop along, see our boss, and says, "Look, any chance of me subbing £2 million?" And the club gave him the money in good faith, and which he effectively banked, and then resigned. But he resigned before the end of August, and therefore, Palace successfully were able to reclaim the money. And I think there were some pretty hefty legal bills as well. So yeah. Silver Tongue Friends had a fantastic day on that. So we do see significant incentives in terms of those clubs, and I think we know who those clubs are, who are in danger of relegation. Can a manager come in and ensure that they preserve their position in the Premier League? Equally, clubs in the Championship where individual wages, I don't think there'll be many on 2 million, if any at all, in the Championship. But they could get a 2 million, there could be a £2 million bonus for the management team quite easily if the club gets promoted. One of the things that we do sometimes see is in the accounts of clubs that go from the Championship to the Premier League, they actually say overall there was a bonus pot of normally in the region of 10 to 15 million pounds for promotion to the Premier League. And of course, that will be shared between players and management.
Mm. What about the FFP question as well?
Right. Oh, yeah. In terms of FFP, these are part of overall wage costs. So therefore, the men's first team's manager wage would be included within FFP, but the academy manager would be exempt. The women's team manager would be exempt as well. Comparing to another part of Kerry's question, comparing to Europe, Premier League manager wages are, it's in a similar case to that of Premier League players' wages, that they tend to be higher than the, practically all clubs, apart from those clubs that are qualified for the Champions League. And that's on the back of the incredibly successful Premier League broadcast deals, which effectively primes the pump in respect of the capacity and ability to pay wages.
I remember talking to Steve Parrish when that whole Tony Pulis thing started. I think he was prepared to bankrupt himself on a point of moral order. He was a very, very angry man about what Pulis tried to do. Pulis is straight. He's a man's man. I think that's what they say, isn't it, Kieran? He's a man's man.
I've got three or four stories on him, which will probably back that up.
Mm-hmm. That's for another pod.
Yes,
we should.
Yes.
That's for the last pod we ever do, Kieran. We're going to go down in flames. Lawrence Bassini, Tony Pulis. Oh my God.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Adam Bassett has our next question. Adam Bassett says, there's been something I've noticed recently at Chelsea. Now, this is a very interesting question, everybody, but you might have to just get a pen and paper and make a few notes because there's a journey here, but it's a good journey. Adam says, there are two brands that sponsor the club called Blue Fuel, a nutrition range, and Perfect Play, a training app, which after some digging turns out to be owned by a separate company called Chelsea Digital Ventures. A lot of the marketing talks about how both are developed in tandem with the coaching and sports science staff at the club, so they're clearly related. My question is this: could Chelsea recognise sales of Blue Fuel as revenue for FFP purposes? We're FFP heavy this week. Would it be that different from other forms of merchandise? If Blue Fuel became a large enough brand, that could be significant revenue, potentially more so than the football operations. It could end up being a reverse Red Bull.
Yeah, this is a fascinating one. I've taken a look at the accounts of Chelsea Digital Ventures. I even put down Logistics News for the purposes of doing that. It's a strange company because it's Chelsea Digital Ventures has been in existence only for a couple of years. And in during that time, it has generated zero income and has lost £18 million.
Oh, wow.
So that's why, presumably, it's not owned by Chelsea Football Club itself, because then it would come under the umbrella of Chelsea and would have made Chelsea Football Club Limited's FFP compliance that much more difficult.
Yeah.
I also went into Chelsea Football Club's accounts, because Chelsea Digital Ventures has its directors in common, and it is deemed to be a related party. And Chelsea Football Club Limited has generated £2 million worth of income by charging to Chelsea Digital Ventures. Now, presumably, this is for using some of the sports science people at Chelsea, and they've had to go and pay a fee for that and so on. So could Chelsea Digital Ventures go on to have a successful product? I think what would happen is that if it's blue fuel and it's it's got the Chelsea badge on it, then it is merchandise, and we are seeing diversification of revenue streams in respect of clubs. Remember, Chelsea have got a hotel effectively on Stamford Bridge, and Bolton have got similar. So clubs are looking at ways of generating money on non-match days. So I think this one conceptually, Adam, is feasible at present. If the blue fuel became as successful as Red Bull, you could see other clubs perhaps going to the Premier League and say, isn't it time that we change the rules?
Yeah.
But at present, I think it's perfectly feasible.
Jack Stevenson has a question that I think most of us have asked, Kieran, since we started doing the pod, essentially, which is why I'm quite happy to ask it again, because I don't know if there is an answer. But Jack Stevens says, recently there's been many stories on the pod about investment groups putting money into various leagues and or clubs. If most owners of football clubs essentially get involved for pride or kudos, with barely any clubs making a profit, what incentive do these investors have to put money into what seems like an almost guaranteed loss maker? It could be the case that I've not been listening avidly enough. Welcome to my world, Jack. But with our owners, the Venkis, subsidising us to the tune of around £20 million a season, it seems like the last industry you put money into expecting a return. And it's so Jack's clearly a Blackburn fan, but it's a question that all football fans ask themselves. Why, when all the evidence shows it's very difficult to make a profit from owning a football club, why do sensible people put the money? And again, Ipswich, you're looking at an American pension fund who have put money into Ipswich, so presumably expecting a return. But you'd imagine it would be a very dodgy investment. Not dodgy is not the right word, but you'd imagine it wouldn't be the first place a pension fund would look to make money out of a football club, would it?
It certainly is a high risk strategy, and I'm not trying to flog the book here, but in the Price of Football book, it does say one of the chapters is why buy a football club, and I've got four headings: love, profit, vanity, and insanity, and that right. That effectively covers if you look at every single owner, you can tick them off to one of those boxes, and some people do get involved for pride and kudos. And let's face it, we both would not have a football club to support had it not been for, in your case, Steve Parish and his friends, and in my case, Tony Bloom and Dick Knight at some point in the future saying, look, this is a financial car crash, but I love the club and I'm going to buy it and we're going to try to survive.
Yeah.
We've both benefited from that, and so have many other clubs as well. At the same time, and some people have left football with their trousers pulled down quite severely. If you think of Randy Lerner at Aston Villa and Tony Gee at Villa, Ellis Short, even though he's probably public enemy number one in the city, Mel Morris has lost a fortune at Derby County.
He's so
lots of people have got into football and have left the industry with a real financial spanking on the back of that. But there are still winners. Unpopular though they may be, the Glazer family put practically nothing into Manchester United to buy the shares because they effectively borrowed the money. But Manchester United could easily be sold for somewhere in the region of £3 to £4 billion.
Yeah.
And the Glazers, remember, have been selling off shares over the course of the last 12 months and paying themselves dividends. So they have been very successful. If we take a look at Fenway Sports Group at Liverpool, Liverpool were bought for £300 million about 10 or 11 years ago. Yeah. They would be able to sell the club for 7 or 8 times that amount today.
Yeah.
Roman Abramovich ran Chelsea at a loss. Now, okay, we know that he's not going to get the proceeds, or we hope he's not going to get the proceeds of sale, but he bought Chelsea Football Club for $140 million. Yes, he's lent it $1.5 billion, but it's still being sold for $2.5 billion. So, yep, under normal circumstances, had he sold it, he would have made a profit.
Yeah.
So some football clubs are an attractive proposition. And I think we are talking about clubs in a relatively rarefied atmosphere. Yeah, we know who these clubs are. They are the ones who are qualifying for the Champions League, who are getting the additional sponsorship deals, who are getting the additional broadcast money on the back of that. But those people that invested in those clubs many years ago are now looking at a positive return. What we are now seeing in relation to American investors in particular, they say, well, if Fenway Sports Group can do it, if the Glazers can do it, well, we can do the same. But, you know, and this is where they're taking a bigger gamble because, no disrespect, if we take a look at the ALK acquisition of Burnley Football Club, that did come with far greater risks. One of the risks being that, you know, 88% of Burnley's revenue comes from the Premier League TV deal. If they're not in the Premier League, there's a problem. But, you know, investors are risk takers. It's the nature of being an investor, and some of them are willing to do this because they genuinely believe that football is hugely undervalued. If we take a look at what Todd Bowley's been saying over the course of the last 2 or 3 weeks, you know, he's now the chairman. He now appears to be some sort of, you know, chief negotiator in terms of football deals and so on. He's really taking a hands-on approach. Because he thinks that I've got an NFL club, there's 170 million people in the world who are keen on the NFL. There's 2 billion that love football. Well, I can make money on the back of this.
Mm. Next question, Kieran, comes from Joe Haining. Joe says it's just a quick one on the fan-led review, but I think this is a really interesting question. So interesting, in fact, Kieran, that I might suggest that you ask Tracy Crouch this question next time you're in that tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. Joe says, at what point would the fan-led review, headed by a politician and with a possible regulator being appointed, tip over into what FIFA might consider government interference, which you sometimes see them imposing sanctions, financial and otherwise, on some countries' football associations? Our concerns over this, perhaps why this present exercise was actually named a fan-led review rather than something like a government review. That's a really interesting question, Kieran.
Yes. And I'm indebted to our friend Stuart Hatcher, who is our friendly lawyer, in respect of some of this as well, because I did have some communication with him. Joe's exactly right. It was a fan-led review. Remember, it was also a cross-party review. I mean, yeah. I presented to the panel, and it included some people from politicians, some people from the House of Lords, but also people like Clark Carlisle, people from the FSA as well.
Right.
So it wasn't just two politicians. And then the review board made recommendations to government with regards to the governance of the game. And I think we need to separate governance from day-to-day activities. So, there was an issue a few years ago when FIFA threatened to suspend the Spanish team from Euro 2008 because the Spanish government at the time wasn't allowing the Spanish Football Federation's elections to proceed. So that was interference in terms of day-to-day activities.
Right, okay.
Every country that I know has a sports minister, and that sports minister, you know, says various pronouncements. So, you know, does that mean football? Yeah, is that interference? Remember, we had Matt Hancock during the early days of COVID pointing out that footballers earn large wages,
yeah.
and therefore, you know, shouldn't they start? You know, is that government interfering? I think we have to be sort of careful as to where does interference. You know, politicians commenting upon football is, you know, they comment upon a variety of things, so I don't think that should be you know, prevented. It's where they get involved in day-to-day activities, and that there have been some evidence of politicians, you know, perhaps trying to interfere in who becomes the manager of the national team, which clubs supply players to the national team, because there are sometimes unusually close links. And this is where FIFA tends to get involved. So, you know, FIFA's statute says that each member shall manage its affairs independently and with no influence from third parties. That's what the Football Association has to be able to prove. And I think it probably can do that, even if there are recommendations which go into a white paper, which eventually becomes legislation.
Well, thank you, Kieran. And thank you, Joe. Good question. Although Kieran sounded a bit defensive there, didn't he? Because there's an implicit criticism of his new girlfriend. Our penultimate question comes from Steve Dunthorne. Steve says, last year Fleetwood Town set up teams in Dubai and South Africa. What are the financial implications of having clubs in different leagues? Presumably the owner intends to fund the foreign clubs, as he does the English parent, but will Fleetwood Town be on the hook for these expenses if for any reason he doesn't meet those costs?
Well, the simple answer, Steve, is no, because these clubs will have been set up as independent companies. And therefore, there is no evidence of cross-subsidisation. The Fleetwood Town owner, Andrew Pilley, is interesting. If you want to if you want to Google Andrew Pilley fraud charges, you might, something might come up.
Spoiler alert.
Yes, but he, I think he is keen on the multi-club ownership model, which we are seeing reflected across a variety of places in football. So I don't see necessarily any problems here. I think they will be independent of one another, and therefore there's nothing to worry from Fleetwood Town's perspective in respect of this.
Last question comes from Joshua Statenfield. And Joshua says, I'm currently looking to start a Sunday league team. Is there any information online about the finances of starting your own team?
Yes, is the simple answer. I contacted my friend Scott McCarthy, who is involved in the running of Hassock's Fat Boys in the Sussex Sunday League, and he was very helpful with regards to this.
Can I just check, Kieran, because I know there's some strange place names in your part of the world. Is it Fat Boys from a place called Hassocks, or is this a village called Hassocks Fat Boys?
No, it is a village called Hassocks.
Right, okay.
I think it's fair to say when the club started, they're sort of fitness and conditioning challenges. but it was started in good faith.
Yes.
This is to give sort of a broad indication of what it's going to cost you. It costs £325 to affiliate with your county FA, but that will include both public liability insurance and personal accident insurance. Then, if you want to, there'll be a couple of cup competitions run by the FA. So that, you know, that might be another £30. That's from the Sussex FA. To join the Sussex Sunday League, it's £80. You've then got to hire a pitch. Pitch hire here, £70 a match, which actually is quite reasonable compared to, I know some of the places in London are extortionate.
Yeah, yeah.
You then need two sets of kit. It's probably cost you £800 a kit. So you need those. You've got training costs. You need to hire somewhere for training, you know, probably between, you know, August through March. So that'll be another £40 a week. It's simple things like nets and balls. You need to buy so many balls. £12 a booking, £40 for a red card, because players are supposed to pay those. And Scott said to me, he's lucky that as far as his club are concerned, most of them are decent lads, but we all are aware of in Sunday League football, those blokes that you sort of wander from club to club. And you know, we certainly had those at my cricket club who were quite legendary. And they never paid fees, so an absolute nightmare. I then went on to the Sussex Sunday FA website, and the tariff of fines is absolutely spectacular. There are 20. There's about 40 different things for which you can be fined for: failure to number shirts, delaying the kickoff due to no change of colours, and you've got a colour kit clash, fielding ineligible players, even things like you know when you used to have really good kids at school who would then go and sign for a Saturday or Sunday team. Well, if they were spotted, if they told the schoolmaster, I can't play on Saturday morning, sir, and then they were then spotted playing on the Saturday or Sunday for a league team because they might be on a bit of boot money, the club can be fined for that. So there's an amazing list of fines. You get fined £10 if the captain fails to wear an armband and stuff like this. It's superb stuff, and it makes you proud to be British. Yeah, you know, this sort of spectacular level of attention to detail.
I'm guessing Joshua stopped listening to this minutes ago because he's lost interest completely. He just thought I'd get 11 mates and start playing football. But if he is still listening, what's that, about £4,000 or £5,000? Totting all that up?
Yeah.
So just to start a Sunday football team, you're looking at a startup cost of around £5,000.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is a labour of love, what you'd normally do is try to get the players to, when they join, pay 40 or 50 quid for registration fees, and then getting the match fees out of them, which can be a complete pain in the backside. Because again, what do you do with that lad who is really good but is never has any cash on him? When we've all been there.
Oh, yeah. I'm not going to name names because they listen to this pod, but... What slightly baffles me about that, Kieran, and this started as a really light-hearted question, but you're talking about £70 for a pitch. That's if you can find a pitch in the first place. I was listening to Dame Tammy Gray-Thompson yesterday on Five Live, the lunch break during the test match, and speaking of which, it's 2 minutes to 11, Kieran, so anything could happen. New Zealand could score 300 in this next session or be bowled out by 10 past 11. But she was talking quite rightly about getting young people involved in sport, getting young men out there. But if it's costing £5,000 and you can't find a pitch, it's much easier said than done, isn't it? That's the problem.
Yeah. It's a shame that there isn't some broader grassroots support for the game. I mean, there are many fantastic local sponsors, and there are local business people who will say, "I'll come along I'll sponsor you for your first year, and I'll come." Players do contribute as well, and also we do find many clubs are ingenious. I played for Trafford Cricket Club for 35 years, and we became really innovative, and also we learned how to access the system. So if there were grants from the RFU or from the ECB, because it was a rugby and a cricket club, well, we learned how to apply for grants. And what you do find is that and perhaps this is I sound terrible. We were quite lucky because we had a rugby club, and we had lawyers, and we had accountants, and we had people working in local government who were able to think about ways of generating additional money. If you are in a city and you just want to set up a local football club and don't want to, and you're never going to have a ground of your own, then it becomes that much more difficult, and it becomes a pain in the arse. You're trying to get subs. You're trying to make sure that the league's kept happy. Somebody gets a yellow card for telling the referee exactly what he thinks of him, and then he disappears. So the club's got to go and find that £12, and loads of clubs are folding as a result of that.
Yeah. Well, Joshua, good luck with your enterprise. Let us know how it goes. And maybe we'll have him as a guest in a couple of months' time.
We'll come along and cheer. If you're local, we'll come along and give you a cheer.
I'm sure things have changed now, but the poor sods around the clubs I used to play for, which was essentially, again, when it comes to the history of football, I played for three different Sunday football teams, but they're all exactly the same blokes. You just change the name. I was going to say for tax purposes, but that wouldn't be true. You just start drinking in a different pub and you change the name of the team. But the two lads who ran the team, their biggest difficulty was finding somebody willing to clean the kit on a particular week and carrying a crossbar. For some reason, all the people I played football with were averse to carrying crossbars out of society. No, it's like, you carry them. No, it's just stupid things that men will argue about. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, that'd be most welcome. You can go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. We'll be back on Thursday with our news story, one of which involves football kits and NFTs, which we're both quite annoyed about. But that's why we decided not to talk about it today. We've got enough on our plate with Derby without Crawley Town's bloody third kit. But in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, as it is 11:02 and the first over has been bowled, I'll keep this very quick. So thanks, as always, for your support. We really appreciate it. You can support us through Patreon if you want. But another way of showing your love for the show, and it does make a difference because it goes into that algorithm, according to Producer Guy, is to go onto your podcast app. And if you can give us a review, if you want to give us 5 stars, we'd be most appreciative. It doesn't matter what you say in the review. The Apple algorithm doesn't pick up on that. So you could say, well, you want something more artistic. You want people who are pure artists and perhaps of the show presented by John Malkovich and Kate Bush. And I personally would listen to that. I think it'd be a fantastic combination.
I wouldn't listen to the John Malkovich bits, but Kate Bush I would listen to. She's one of my idols. I've gone now, Kieran. We'll have to say goodbye. Bye, everybody.
Bye. The Price of Football. Price of Football.